A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 73. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about The Invisible Man. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, indeed, The Invisible Man. And the premise for our show under discussion is a laboratory accident turns scientist Peter Brady completely invisible. And the question is, what will he do with his newfound powers of invisibility?
This was a 1958 TV series from ITV. It was loosely based on the H.G. Wells novel, The Invisible Man, and based on the character of the Invisible Man from H.G. Wells. And it was actually billed as H.G. Wells, The Invisible Man. So that was kept up front where it was coming from, which was nice.
Yeah, they stuck at the source material, certainly for the character and for some of the sort of classic features of the Invisible Man, as we'll discuss as we go along. But they did drift away from Wells's original story, obviously, which we'll also discuss. 26 episodes broadcast on ITV in 1958 and in 1959. They're about 25 minutes each episode, and they went out in two series, we think. 13 episodes in 1958, and then they came back with a second series of 13 episodes in 59. They're all pretty much standalone episodes, Brian. There's not an awful lot of continuity between them.
Yes, that's right. It was definitely the mini adventure of the week is the type of thing that they did with it.
Yeah, it's an adventure of a week show, and as such, it was therefore suitable for syndication to be shown in different orders around the world. So it was quite successfully sold abroad, I think, by the ITV network here in the UK.
That's right. Now, the setup for The Invisible Man involves Dr. Peter Brady, who is working on problems of optical density and how light and refraction work. And he briefly manages to make a guinea pig fade out from visibility and become invisible for a moment and then reappear again, become visible again. And the work involves some sort of radioactivity. It's not exactly clear how or why that is, but it does mean that you need to have a certain amount of resilience to that in order to undergo this process. And he accidentally, of course, runs this process on himself and makes himself completely invisible, and permanently so. He cannot turn himself visible again, and that becomes part of what he's working on throughout the series, is he's trying to make himself visible again.
And the sequence where he makes himself accidentally invisible, I mean, that happens right up front in the first episode before the titles appear. It's very much a sort of pre-title sequence. So it really gets going very quickly. And then, of course, once he is invisible, he starts to deal with some of the problems of that, which is that the British government are immediately interested when they hear about this accident, and they try to keep him almost, I think, you know, a top secret, and also some form of special weapon. They're trying to keep him under lock and key. And then there's a rival scientist who's trying to steal some of the secrets and find out how this has happened. And as a result of all this, Peter Brady has to escape from the laboratory and go on the run, which, of course, in the first episode, he's able to do because he's now invisible. But by the end of the episode, I think they've rapidly sort of resolved the difficulties. And in effect, the government and British intelligence sort of recruit Peter Brady as a sort of super spy, realizing that an invisible spy is probably the best one they can get.
Yes, and Brady becomes a spy and an agent for all sorts of people and all sorts of things, it seems. He acts regularly as a sort of Good Samaritan, helping, dare I say, damsels in distress, and rescuing people, clearing people's names, and so on. And this becomes part of the theme of the show as well.
Yeah, when he's not working for the British government, he seems to be working, as you say, for damsels in distress or for friends and family who get themselves into scrapes, which can only be solved by an invisible man, which is very convenient.
Yes, absolutely. Now, there are several characters involved as regulars in The Invisible Man, so let's talk about those.
Okay, well, first off, we have the man himself, the Invisible Man, or Dr. Peter Brady, who rather mysteriously is credited on the TV series as being played by himself, the actual Invisible Man. And interestingly, we never see his face in the whole series. When we see him in this pre-credits or pre-title sequence turning invisible, we only ever see his back towards the camera, or there's one brief shot where we see his eyes looking through a hatch at an experiment he's conducting. And of course, shortly afterwards, he's completely invisible. So we never really get to see the actor who's playing the Invisible Man. And of course, Brian, he's portrayed in sort of classic Invisible Man style, almost from the H.G. Wells novel itself, in that he covers himself in bandages and dark goggle-like glasses, and he wears a hat and gloves and a big heavy coat.
Yes, that was very much from the H.G. Wells novel. In fact, I would say the general concept and the look of how he's dressed is really what they took from the novel and from the character. And we'll talk about that a bit more, but that really is the influence from H.G. Wells.
So we've got this classic appearance of the Invisible Man who, you know, is all done up in bandages and his dark glasses. And as far as we know, a variety of different actors actually played the part inside the suit as the series went on over the 26 episodes. But you may, if you're watching the episodes, certainly the early ones, you may recognise the Invisible Man's voice, because they chose a voice for him, the voice of an actor called Tim Turner. And you might recognise that voice because Tim Turner also dubbed the voice of Jason in the very famous 1963 Ray Harryhausen film Jason of the Argonauts, when it was thought that the lead actor, Todd Armstrong, had too much of an American accent, and that would...
Poor Todd,
that's right. That wouldn't fit in with the rest of the British cast, so they got Tim Turner to dub his voice. Although, strangely enough, they actually chose Tim Turner for this series, The Invisible Man, because he could do a sort of transatlantic American accent, and they wanted some American accents because they very much wanted to sell this show to American TV networks.
Yes, this isn't the only time this has been done, of course, but they had an American-sounding voice for the lead actor and sort of 1950s leading man kind of voice, and generally British voices for everyone else. While Tim Turner was the main voice for the Invisible Man, there were some episodes, I think it was the latter part of the first season and maybe even a bit of the early second season, they used a different voice. There was no explanation, but they had a different voice for a little while, or it certainly sounded like it anyhow, and then it came back to Tim Turner again.
Yes, you picked up on this, didn't you, Brian, that there were different voice actors used for some episodes?
Yes, there were, but at the time, I don't think they announced or credited who any of the voice actors or body actors were. And that was part of the selling point, was that no one knew who the Invisible Man was.
Part of the mystery of the show.
Absolutely. There were some other characters as well, of course. Diane was Brady's sister, played by Lisa Dinelli. And that gives some sort of domestic quality that Brady, at least for the time of the series, is living with his sister. So there's sort of a household and some banter that goes back and forth. And, you know, sometimes he's wearing the visible bandages and things, and sometimes he's just walking around with no visible clothing and so on and so forth. In addition, there was a second character giving us some of that normality and social aspect, and that was Sally, Diane's daughter, so the Invisible Man's niece, played by Deborah Watling. And she very calmly seems to accept her invisible uncle and joins in and forms part of a number of the adventures. Sometimes she's just there and not important to the story. Sometimes she is sort of central to the adventure that happens, and so on. She definitely becomes involved. And of course, British sci-fi fans well may know the name Deborah Watling because she went on to play Victoria, a companion for the Second Doctor on Doctor Who. That was nearly a decade later, so she was, I guess, somewhere around 10 years old as Sally on The Invisible Man and somewhere around 20 as Victoria on Doctor Who.
Yeah, that's right. And as you say, it's very interesting. I mean, his sister Diane is initially sort of shocked when she sees him because, covered in bandages, she thinks he's been in quite a different sort of accident to the one he's actually had. But Sally is quite amazing. She just accepts that she's got an invisible uncle and carries on quite calmly, as if it's perfectly normal.
Yes, she has a fun time of it, doesn't she?
Absolutely. We should also mention the Invisible Man's boss, or a character who sort of appears to be his superior from time to time, and that is the character of Sir Charles Anderson, who was initially played by the actor Ernest Clarke, and he represents the British government and British intelligence, and he's very much the sort of the character of M, if Dr. Brady is the James Bond super spy. And then in later episodes, rather strangely and without any explanation, they just had to replace the actor. So a different actor, Ewan Macduff, would turn up as, again, Sir Charles Anderson in some of the later episodes in Series 2.
Well, that is consistent if you're comparing him to M.
True, yes, I guess so. Yes, different actors have portrayed M over the years, yep. And, of course, different Bonds.
Yes. Yeah, Sir Charles was more easygoing than an M-type character, I would say. He would sometimes bring Brady in and ask him to do something, and sometimes Brady would go and do his own thing and then call Sir Charles for some information or for access to something or someplace or something like that. And Sir Charles was always very cooperative, it seemed.
Well, there was an accident in the lab this morning.
An accident?
Yes, something went wrong with one of the conductors. I caught the full blast.
Pete!
Now, take it easy, Dee. See? Good, solid hand.
So, our production notes for The Invisible Man. The Invisible Man was a production by a chap called Ralph Smart, who started out as a film director in the British film industry, where he worked reasonably successfully producing what were known as quota quickies for the British film industry between the wars, when there was an Act of Parliament that required distributors to show so many British films a year, and therefore film companies were sort of rushing out several very quick projects. So he was quite good at doing those. And then after his stint in the forces during World War II, he returned, but this time began producing quite a number of successful TV sort of action-adventure shows, including this one, but also quite famously, The Adventures of Robin Hood. That's the 1950s version with the very well-known theme song. But also William Tell, and with Patrick McGoohan, he produced Danger Man, a long-running secret agent show, which, as we discussed quite some time ago on British Invaders, may or may not have been some of the influence for Patrick McGoohan's own show, The Prisoner.
Yes, Danger Man and The Prisoner were definitely related in some way.
So that's Ralph Smart, who was keen on these productions and these very sort of action-adventure-orientated weekly shows. And I guess he was looking for a new show.
Yeah, and he thought that H.G. Wells' book, The Invisible Man, would be good for a TV series. But he, for television in the 50s, decided that really he should move it away from the original character of the Invisible Man, who was sort of a power-crazed thug who deliberately turned himself invisible in order to take advantage of people. And they made him much more of a conventional sort of super spy type character, and a very upstanding individual. Most of the early episodes of The Invisible Man were directed by Pennington Richards, who did the classic British POW film, The Wooden Horse.
And then several writers on the show, lots of different people for the 26 episodes. A couple of names that we should pick out, a chap called Ian Stuart Black, who would go on to write three different Doctor Who stories, including the Macra Terror for the Second Doctor. Michael Pertwee, another Doctor Who connection, because he was in fact John Pertwee's brother, who would be, of course, the Third Doctor. And then Brian Clemens, who appears on the credits using one of his pen names, Tony O'Grady. And Brian Clemens would go on to write quite a bit of The Avengers and another series called Adam Adamant Lives. And again, another quite well-known British genre writer on television over the years.
Absolutely. Clemens was one of the contributors to the creation of The Avengers, and he's written lots of stage plays and things as well.
And then Ralph Smart recruited a puppeteer, a chap called Jack Whitehead, who had worked on a very famous children's puppet show on television called Muffin the Mule. And of course, he was a natural choice to sort of coordinate many of the rather inventive special effects that they would need to recreate the actions of the Invisible Man for this series. So he did lots of the stuff with wires and strings. So we see lots of objects floating. We see telephones being lifted off off the hook. We see floating guns. We see cigarettes, wine glasses. We see the Invisible Man holding newspapers and turning over papers. And a lot of this stuff was done with strings and wires. Quite a lot of setup required, apparently.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And they also had a couple of Invisible Man suits for the Invisible Man with the bandages and the glasses and everything. And one of them had a plaster cast with a bandaged head that could be worn by a very short actor, a guy called Johnny Scripps. So the head of the costume, of the suit with the bandages on it, was actually above the actor's head. So you could remove the glasses and the hat and you would see nothing there, just the bandages wrapped around what appeared to be nothing. And yeah, they certainly did all kinds of things for making it appear that there was an invisible man there. Like so many super spies, there had to be a distinctive car. So the invisible man drove an open-topped Austin Healey sports car, which often he would drive wearing all the bandages, but sometimes not.
Yes, and when he was driving it completely invisible, they would have to have a stuntman hiding in the footwell of the car and apparently looking out at the road ahead through a small cutout in the dashboard and then steering the car. I suspect that when they did that, we're looking at speeded up film, but even so, it must have been quite scary for the stuntmen driving these cars along. And also, we know from some of the stories about this series that it did cause some consternation to the general public when they would see what was appeared to be driverless cars whizzing down the road.
I can imagine. I guess they must have used different techniques for the driverless motorcycle.
Yes, well, that's right. There was also a driverless motorcycle and sidecar as well. And quite how they managed that, we don't know. But some of the effects, you know, are quite well done. There's a sequence where he actually removes his bandages on screen, and I suspect it's using very early sort of chroma key separation, but that worked quite well. But also we should mention that as well as stuntmen driving cars, there's a number of stuntmen and also supporting actors who are basically required to be beaten up by the Invisible Man or to be punched or overpowered by the Invisible Man. So we see characters and actors and stuntmen basically throwing themselves around on set and beating themselves up, which is moderately amusing at times, Brian.
Yeah, some of those are reasonably convincing. They did all kinds of things to do the Invisible Man effect, and sometimes you could see wires and strings holding things up, but a lot of the time you couldn't. And for what they had and for the time, it was actually quite impressive, the number of things they pulled off in a weekly series and how good it often looked.
There's quite an interesting little snippet on one of the commentary tracks I've been listening to where Lisa Danielli and Deborah Watlin are talking about their experience on the set while they were making The Invisible Man and how they would walk onto the set not realizing that the special effects crew and the puppeteer had spent hours setting up the wires and strings that would be needed for all the Invisible Man effects, and they would walk onto the set and blunder through these things and cause quite a bit of distress to Jack Whitehead and his crew, as you can imagine.
There was also an unaired pilot of The Invisible Man, which Ralph Smart rejected because the strings and wires and things were just too visible. And the actor inside the bandages actually really couldn't see and kept walking into things. And that was quite unusual for British TV, certainly at the time, for them to have a pilot episode at all. So I suspect what they did is they filmed an episode expecting it to be the first episode for broadcast. And when it was looked at by Ralph Smarden, he rejected it. They said, okay, we'll call that a pilot, and then started a new one. And that became the broadcast version.
Right.
I suspect that's what happened. Certainly that's what happened with Doctor Who originally.
Right.
And I suspect it may have been similar here.
Yeah, I think so. Although they did keep some of the elements of the unaired pilot, they kept the bits that obviously did work, and they recycled them later on in the series as an episode called Bank Raid, where the Invisible Man is effectively blackmailed into robbing a bank, something else that he'd be quite good at.
Absolutely. So I think that just about wraps it up for the first half of our Invisible Man discussion. So next time we'll look at some of the episodes of The Invisible Man, and we'll talk about some of the ups and downs and some of the guest stars who were involved and appeared in this series.
Quite a few of those to talk about. We've also got to get to our own comments on the series and our reviews and talk about the availability of The Invisible Man, so you can find out how you can in fact see The Invisible Man, should you wish to.
Absolutely. So, you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. So, thank you for listening, and please listen to our second half of this. And this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much for joining us. Please come back next time, and until then, this is goodbye from Eamon England.